All right. Welcome, everybody. Thank you all for coming. For today, our speaker is Nick Schweitzer. He's coming to us from the law school. He's returning, I think he was here about 3 years ago to give the same lecture, which is a nice refreshing take on what we usually hear here. He's going to be talking about evolution in the public schools and the court system. Take it away.
Thank you, Jared.
It is a pleasure and a privilege to talk to you about cases in the U.S. court system over the past century that have dealt with the teaching of evolution in public schools. This presentation will obviously be a bit of a departure from your normal Thursday noon lectures, some of which I have attended in the past. I will not mention clades. There will be no mass spectroscopy. And I won't use any Latin terms, even legal ones. So, here are the major topics I'll be covering. I will not read all of my slides, but occasionally I will when I think they're pretty important. So, the three things I want to talk about today are the history of teaching and not teaching, biological evolution in the public schools as reflected in a series of U.S. court cases. Then, as a response to those, the what I call evolution of the approaches that believers in creation, in a divine creation, have used to teach a biblical alternative, or to water down the teaching of biological evolution, or to eliminate it altogether. So that has changed over time. And finally, I'm going to end with a description of the current assaults on the teaching of biological evolution to show that the fight's not over. We must be prepared to defend science in public education. So, major court cases, there are seven of them that I'm going to touch on. There are other decisions. Some of them raise interesting issues. Many of them are the same issues but in different jurisdictions, but we don't have time to cover those. Now, I use the word jurisdiction. That's as much legality as I'm going to get into here, but it's an important concept. And if you don't know it, the next minute or two are important. The geographic jurisdiction of courts in the United States is an important concept. In both the state and the federal legal systems, a court can only adjudicate actions within its territory. And its decisions only affect that territory. In other words, which courts have jurisdiction over what geographic areas? And what geographic areas are bound by those courts' decisions? You'll see a couple of examples of that as we go through. This slide, I hope, summarizes that. Now, I don't know how many of you have even thought about the strange situation where debates about religion and science in the public schools are decided in the courts. But that's the way it is, largely because it involves a constitutional issue. Specifically, I'm sure you know that there's a First Amendment to our Constitution. It says that there shall be no law respecting the establishment of a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And those are things that, as you know, are being discussed and debated and argued over right now with other topics. Not so much evolution, but other things at the highest level. And the 14th Amendment made that applicable to the states, not just the federal government. Okay. The story starts with the case of Tennessee versus John Thomas Scopes. It's commonly referred to as the Scopes Monkey Trial. I apologize to those of you who know this case probably up and down. But again, if there are some of you who don't know the details of this, it is a couple of minutes well spent to understand where this all started. It took place in a district court at the state level in Dayton, Tennessee, in 1925. In that year, Tennessee enacted a law that made it unlawful for any teacher in any public school to teach any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible. or to teach that man has descended from lower orders of animals. Now, there's an organization, national organization called the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, which gets involved in a lot of cutting-edge cases. They saw the danger in the laws like this, and they issued this statement even before Tennessee passed its law, which basically said, we will come and help you fight any such law and any anti-evolution legislation. Shortly after the law was passed, certain citizens in the town of Dayton realized that it was probably going to become a challenge, and that challenge would generate publicity, and that publicity might generate tourism and other things, and they decided that it might as well be their map, their town that was put on the map for the challenge. So they enlisted John Thomas Scopes, who was a high school biology teacher, who said yes, he had taught the forbidden subject in his biology class, and he agreed to the idea of becoming the test case. So the authorities were informed, and he was charged with having violated the law. Here is John Thomas Scopes. I'm not sure whether he goes by his first or his middle name. I've seen both, so I use both. He was 24 years old, as I said, a high school biology teacher at the time. Looking at him, I think he could be any of us. Maybe not me, I'm a little old for this. But any of you, especially after you graduate, whether you're teaching or doing something else, you could end up being involved in something like this. The ACLU, mentioned in the previous slide, enthusiastically volunteered to defend Scopes in this trial. Shortly after that, even more volunteered help came from Clarence Darrow, the person on the left. At the time, he was America's most famous trial lawyer. He had a formidable reputation as a defense lawyer for unpopular causes and defendants, and he was an avowed and staunch atheist. On the other side was the town prosecutor, who was clearly outgunned, but he was soon joined by William Jennings Bryan. He was one of the few people in America whose reputation matched that of Clarence Darrow at the time. He had been the Democratic candidate for president 3 times, and although by 1925 he had retired from politics, he was still active in a number of campaigns, including anti-evolution. He volunteered to assist the prosecution. Here are a couple of the things that Bryan said, give you a sort of a flavor of the time. He said, science is magnificent. It can perfect machinery, but it adds no moral restraints to protect from the misuse of the machinery. He also said, Darwinian theory represents man at his worst, the law of hate, the merciless law, whereby the survival of the fittest. And this was actually very prominent in the U.S. at this time, what is still called social Darwinism. The concept that the survival of the fittest is what decides who goes on and who gets left behind. It informed, I think, some of the other movements in the early 20th century, too. Here's a cartoon from the time. And it was actually closely related with William Jennings Bryan, though he's not. He's saying, if you can't read it, the Pied Piper, which is science, falsely so-called, who is playing the tune of the Darwinian hypothesis of evolution on the path of education, is leading to disbelief in the God of the Bible. Very common opinion then and among certain people now. Bryan felt that evolution would lead people to disbelieve in God, and I'm not so sure he wasn't right about that. I think it has had that effect on certain people, at least. With such two luminaries in charge, the case soon became much more than just a battle over what was essentially a $100 fine. It became a mythic crusade. For Brian, it was against Darwinism, against Darrow, against evolution and atheism. For Darrow, it was against Brian and against narrow-minded religious fanaticism. The town of Dayton has, even more than anticipated, filled up with tourists, newspapermen, hucksters. Signs appeared all over the town reading such things as, "Read your Bible, God is love, where will you spend eternity?" Useful phrases. The trial lasted 8 days. There was a lot of testimony. At one point, one of the digressions I cannot take time for is Brian's own testimony about the infallibility of the Bible and the cross-examination of him on that issue. It is fascinating to read. Brian also died a few days after the trial, and people have interpreted that a couple of different ways. He did say right after the trial that he was immensely happy with the result, and he literally said something like, "If I were to die soon, I would die happy." Others thought that he died because he didn't like the way he'd been treated. I need to go on. It lasted 8 days. The jury predictably, and I think accurately, found that he had violated the law, and the judge imposed a penalty of $100. This story is very well told in this book, Summer of the Gods. It won the Pulitzer Prize for History in 1998, and the author, Edward Larson, got his PhD from here, UW, in 1984. Many of you are probably familiar with another representation of that trial, which is a play called Inherit the Wind. It was produced as a play, and then it was made into a movie 4 different times. You should be familiar with that trial, the Scopes trial, or the Scopes monkey trial, just because it is part of U.S. popular culture. And any discussion about the teaching of evolution, even today, will include references to it. Let me go back now, though, to the jurisdictional issue that I mentioned at the beginning. The case was in a state court in Tennessee. They found that the law was okay. Scopes had violated it. He had to pay a fine. But the effect of that was only in Tennessee. That trial only decided the outcome for Tennessee. It did not get appealed to any U.S. federal court, let alone to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I have to talk about that coming up. So, the rest of the cases aren't nearly as well known as Scopes, but they actually reflect this strange sort of what I call evolution. They represent the adaptation by the opponents of evolution to the changing legal environment. And I'm going to talk about each of these. This is the sequence in which challenges to the teaching of evolution have been and still are being made. First was to prohibit the teaching of evolution. After that was attacking secular humanism as a religion. After that was equal time in classes for the Genesis account. Then required equal time of something called creation science and evolution. We'll talk about that. And then about modification of that, balanced treatment of that, either teach both or neither. It should be neither. Finally, the required teaching of something called intelligent design. I'm pretty sure you all have brushed up against that concept by now. And then at the end, I'll talk about what may be next. The next case of consequence isn't until 1967. It isn't a case that anyone knows, but I think it is really the most important. Following the Scopes trial in 1925, a number of other states passed anti-evolution laws. The next one was Mississippi, 1926. The ACLU made a similar offer of legal assistance to anyone who would oppose it, but no one with any standing took them up on it. As a general statement, the anti-evolution sentiment was much stronger in southern states than in the northern. For example, in 1927, anti-evolution bills were introduced but went nowhere in six northern states, and I like the fact that Rhode Island, when it received that bill, referred it to the Committee on Fish and Game. Shortly, though, back in 1928, Arkansas was one of the ones that passed a law. The language is essentially identical to that of the law that was on the books in Tennessee. And it said, it is unlawful for any teacher to teach the theory or doctrine that mankind ascended or descended from a lower order of animals. It would become the subject of this next court challenge, but not for over three decades. There were no challenges in large part because the actual teaching of evolution in public schools, partly as a reaction to the Scopes trial, was downplayed greatly for many, many years. And it wasn't until the 1960s that biology textbooks began to make evolution a little more prominent. In fact, textbooks had been published in the intervening years which didn't have the word evolution in the index, even if it was mentioned in the text. So you couldn't find it. Starting in the 1950s, organizations like the National Science Foundation made a push to teach science better. They funded a biological sciences curriculum study. It recommended the teaching of evolution. It wasn't really until the 1960s that it started catching on, largely because of Russia, or at that time the USSR. You may remember that they sent a satellite into space before we did, and all of a sudden we discovered maybe we'd better be teaching our students science. So, by 1964, some publishers began putting more references, more material into their textbooks. The teachers in Little Rock High School in Arkansas recommended the use of a biology textbook which contained an entire chapter on evolution for the following year, and it was adopted. Susan Epperson was one of the teachers who voted for the textbook, but because teaching it was going to cause her to break the law, she filed a suit in county court asking to nullify the law and also asking for what's called an injunction to prevent her from being dismissed if she taught it. This became Epperson versus Arkansas. This one went to the Supreme Court, which I'll talk about. It was heard. To his credit, I'm sure it was his at that time, the judge in the Arkansas County Court found that the Arkansas law was unconstitutional. However, it was appealed out of Arkansas to the Arkansas Supreme Court, which overturned the district judge's ruling, finding that it was a valid exercise of school curriculum. That was appealed, however, to the U.S. Supreme Court, which did find that the Arkansas law was unconstitutional. U.S. Supreme Court said, the overriding fact is that Arkansas's law selects from the body of knowledge a particular segment which it proscribes, which it condemns, for the sole reason that it is deemed to conflict with the particular religion's doctrine, that is, with the Book of Genesis. So, U.S. Supreme Court, in the Epperson case, established a precedent, made a decision, which applied nationwide. That's why I say I think it is the most important of these cases. However, this electrified the conservative forces. I think all of these organizations were created around this time to defend the biblical description of creation in Genesis and also other conservative efforts. The organizations began searching to find ways to educate children in the biblical explanation of creation and human origins without simply prohibiting the teaching of evolution. Now I'm going to take just one sidetrack here, which is a case I particularly like. It's not directly in the line. But it was Willoughby versus Stever, and I really appreciated this guy's argument. Willoughby's claim was that by teaching evolution, you were creating a religion, the religion of secular humanism, trying to make secular humanism the official religion of the United States. The U.S. District Court had no trouble figuring out that equating science was not secular humanism and that it was not a religion. It was upheld on appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court said we don't even want to review it. Okay, back to the main issue. In 73, Tennessee passed its next step in legislation. And it said, any biology textbook shall give an equal amount of time, equal amount of emphasis, on the Genesis account in the Bible. A suit was filed by a number of school teachers. The first named one was Joseph Daniel, and the defendant was Hugh Waters, the chairman of the textbook commission. This one was also decided by the district court, which said, giving a preferential position for the biblical version of creation as opposed to scientific reasoning is establishing a religion which is contrary to the First Amendment. So that one went nowhere. It was appealed to the Court of Appeals that upheld it. It didn't go any farther. The anti-evolution forces at this point figured we cannot insist on teaching the Bible. So they came up with the idea that creation is a science. Creation science. We're going to teach creation science along with evolution. And here's pretty much the definition of creation science at that time. The scientific evidences for creation, including that the universe was created suddenly, that mutation and natural selection are insufficient to develop all the living kinds that we have today. That a species cannot actually change into another species. There are only changes within fixed limits. You can change certain things, but you can't create new kinds. That there is a completely separate ancestry. I'm surprised they even use the word ancestry for man and apes. That there is catastrophism, including a worldwide flood. And finally, that all of the earth and the living kinds are relatively recent inception, which I think is about the same as the first. So, but this is now being promoted as an alternative scientific explanation for man, their real concern. So, it starts in Arkansas. Oh, this is the Arkansas case. The Institute for Creation Research, one of the groups I mentioned earlier, prepared model legislation that was sent out to the various states. This is done now. Anyone familiar with ALEC, A-L-E-C? It's the American Legislative Exchange Council. They, even today, I mean, they are preparing model legislation. They are a conservative group, sending it out to all the state legislatures and saying, why don't you adopt this? And many of these bills are introduced, and a few of them are passed. In 1981, Arkansas passed the law based on that model legislation that required the teaching of creation science along with evolution. There was a lawsuit, of course. A group of parents, religious groups, organizations, biologists, and others filed suit, claiming that the law was unconstitutional. The very first named plaintiff was Reverend William McLean, a United Methodist minister, to show that it's not just religion versus science. The other complainants are listed here. This became McLean versus Arkansas Board of Education. And the Federal District Court ruled that creation science is religion and not science. The losing side in this case apparently didn't want to create a wider precedent than Arkansas. So it wasn't appealed. Creation science wasn't quite dead. It would take another 5 years before the issue finally reached the U.S. Supreme Court, leading to a nationwide ruling. There was a Louisiana law, also passed in 1981, that required the teaching of creation science if evolutionary science is taught. Sorry. Once again, a suit was brought, mostly by the parents of children attending the public schools. First plaintiff was Don Aguillard. The defendant was Governor Edwards of Louisiana. In support of this suit, you can read 72 Nobel-winning scientists, et cetera, et cetera, filed legal documents called amicus briefs to support the claims. The district court, as in Arkansas, found that the purpose of the law was to promote a religious doctrine of creation science. And this was upheld by the U.S. Court of Appeals, and it went on to the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm not exactly sure why the proponents of creation science thought they might win at that time, but it was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. It ruled that it endorses religion by advancing the religious belief, et cetera, et cetera, and it violates the First Amendment. So now we have a nationwide precedent against creation science, and that's pretty much the end of creation science. We have to move on to something else. Before I do that, though, I want to note 7-2. If you were to take a constitutional law class, as I have done, you would know that an awful lot of time is spent talking about how Justice Warren ruled or how Justice Ginsburg will rule on something. It comes down to personalities at times. And then talking about whether you can use that information to predict the next court case. This is the only one I will impose on you, but I think it is relevant. The two justices who would have ruled differently in the Edwards case were Justice Rehnquist, who is no longer on the court, Justice Scalia. And he wrote this, which is, you see this an awful lot in the discussion. It's basically, teach the controversy. He says, I'm astonished by the reaction that says we shouldn't teach, etc. It seems to me the court's position is a repressive one. The people of Louisiana are entitled to have whatever scientific evidence there may be against evolution. It's sort of hard to argue with that. And when expressed in the right way, maybe that's not so bad. The ACLU has not tried to do anything with this, but they talk about this as what they call a Trojan horse, or a camel's nose under the tent, or you know, this may be a way in which you can get teaching of alternatives, specifically religious alternatives, in. Okay. So, after creation science was scotched, the next development was intelligent design. Foundation for Thought and Ethics was one of the leading organizations in promoting it, and here are a couple of definitions of it. The first was by Michael Behe, who's a very prominent supporter of the idea, and the second one I wrote up, just because I thought it actually expressed it a little bit better and more concisely, but intelligent design, which was of great importance a decade or so ago, was the idea that some things in nature are so inherently complex that they could not have arisen step by step in evolution. And that the strong appearance of some sort of design in life is real, and that there must have been, sometimes the word is, an intelligent agent. They never use the word God or divide, but that some designer must have created this designer. The complexity we observe is impossible to explain on an evolutionary basis, Irreducible complexity is one of the phrases, and one of the favorite illustrations is the bacterial flagellum. It is so complex that it could not have arisen without having been designed. How does this thing come about? I won't try to explain. The scientific evidence in the next case, however, did an excellent job of it. And I'll show you where you can read about that. This was, in fact, brought up in the Dover case, which is coming up soon. It was referred to over and over again, to the point where when the 33rd witness brought it up on the screen, the judge said, "We've seen that." But the unlikely battlefield for this was Dover, Pennsylvania, population 2,000. Around 2004, the Dover Area School District in Pennsylvania was in need of new biology textbooks. The high school biology teachers recommended this text, which came to be referred to as the Dragonfly Book. The school board, with the strong support of a couple of those organizations I mentioned before, including the Thomas More Law Center, decided that it disliked this because it discusses evolution. And it chose an alternate text that discussed intelligent design as an alternative. And the text, which then became referred to as the panda text, of pandas and people. It was prepared by Foundation of Thought of Ethics. It teaches that life shows evidence of being designed by an intelligent agent. Doesn't mention God, doesn't mention Bible or divine, merely an intelligent agent. Pennsylvania was one of many places where this debate was going on. It still was, an important debate at the time. Here's an excerpt from the text. It just says, "Intelligent design means various forms of life began abruptly through an intelligent agency with distinctive features already intact, etc. They were made, not evolved." All of the high school science teachers in the Dover School District wrote a letter to the school board stating that ID, intelligent design, was not science and refusing to teach it as a violation of their professional duty not to misrepresent subject matter in class. Now, the teachers were understandably concerned that they might all be fired. But in the town of 2000, the school board really didn't have the resources to replace all of them, so initially they got away with it. However, the school board adopted the supplementary textbook anyway, having both of them in the classroom. Even so, the high school teachers objected. And a group of 11 parents of high school teachers filed suit in the federal district court in Pennsylvania, seeking an injunction against the teaching policy. The first named plaintiff was Tammy Kitzmiller. This became the case of Kitzmiller versus Dover Area School District. The details of the trial, the extensive expert scientific testimony, the documentary evidence are really quite interesting. Even though the immediate issue has passed, you might want to look at it. You can read about them in a book called The Monkey Girl. I consider that an unfortunate title. Apparently that was used on the playground one day. But it is a very good discussion of the issue. It includes the history leading up to the trial, all the way back to Scopes, the personalities involved, and the evidence that was presented in the case. The other book, The Devil in Dover, is not too bad. It was written by a local Dover journalist. It focuses more on the individuals and the personalities of everyone involved. The trial included, as I said, a lot of scientific testimony, a lot of quasi-scientific testimony. One of the most fascinating and compelling parts of the trial, and I'm going to show you just a couple here, was the result of a relatively simple matter of comparing two versions of the panda textbook. The attorneys for the plaintiff teachers made what is called a discovery demand in law to the publisher of the textbook for its files and its previous copies of the books. It turned out that they got a gold mine. or as one of the witnesses said, the smoking gun. So, starting here, here are two different versions of the same sentence.
Yeah. In 1993, we're talking about intelligence design means this. In 1986, it was creation means that the wording is exactly the same,
except for substituting the word intelligent design for creation, intelligent agency for creator. That was damning enough. I mean, that was, yes. Even more surprising is this, the very last sentence in the first one. Evolutionists think the former is correct. Creationists accept the latter view. Evolutionists think the former is correct. Should we not agree with it? Except the latter view. That's obviously the result of a search and replace, right? And as someone commented, by using this search and replace activity, they had created a missing link, a transitional fossil. This is the design proponent of this. The scientific evidence, the trial was thorough. The decision was very well written. The judge, who had been a Republican appointee, came down unreservedly in favor of science. The court ruled that intelligent design is not science. It granted the injunction permanently. It granted the injunction permanently, barring the board from maintaining the ID policy in any school within the district, from requiring teachers to disparage evolution or to refer to ID. That last slide was a surprise to me. Let me just see what I did. Oh, okay. I think I do want to show you that. This is also from the trial. This was part of the testimony of the trial, not the documentary evidence that I just showed you. But Behe, whom I mentioned before, was talking about irreducible complexity. And he said, the bacterial flagellum. It would take 100 million generations to develop a novel feature through Darwinian evolution. Figure I'm sure he just came pulled out of the air. But even so, he was faced with his previous testimony, which said that there are 10,000 generations in 2 years, and therefore it would only take 20,000 years to develop the bacterial flagellum. I mean, if you countenanced his testimony at all. All right. The decision by the district court was not appealed, not surprisingly. And based on what I explained at the beginning about jurisdiction, it is controlling law only in the Central District of Pennsylvania now. You could teach ID somewhere else and you wouldn't actually be in violation of this decision. The entire story is, well, much more than this story. The book on the left is by Ron Numbers, who retired just a couple of years ago from his position as professor of history of science and medicine. And this is considered the definitive work on not just this series of cases, but much more. The other one is a collection of essays that's published by NCSE. I'm going to refer to them again, National Center for Science Education. One of the editors is Ange Petto, who teaches at UW-Milwaukee. So both of them have UW connections. That's pretty much the history I'm bringing you to. The question is, what's the next evolutionary step? I'm going to present a few things, and with any luck, we'll have a few minutes at the end for comments, and there are some people I know in the audience who know this even better than I do, may want to comment on some of the things I've said. Nevertheless, current attacks on science education. There are lots of recent proposals across the country. Most of them have died. One or two have been implemented. NCSE has provided most of this information. There's a map of places where legislation has been introduced. And let me start off to the side just a little bit saying these, I'm going to show you bills that have been introduced that are still trying to chip away. But the conservatives' real hope is that they will get a case up to the Supreme Court when there is a conservative majority who will decide that it is okay to teach biblical creation in the public schools. For whatever reason, that is one of the greatest hopes, and they're sort of waiting. As you may know, Justice Ginsburg has delayed what probably would have been her retirement had she not been, you know, desperate to maintain a liberal voice on the court. She's probably waiting at least through the election in 2020. That having been said, all of those well-funded research institutes are trying to come up with model legislation and new approaches in state legislatures. Here, for example, just the Institute for Creation Research, $7 million budget, 49 employees, 9 PhDs. Their goal is to prove scientifically that the biblical account is true. I think that's a hopeless effort, but they've got a lot of money trying to do it. The first one I'll show you is really quixotic, meaning hopeless. But around the time of Dover, South Dakota a South Dakota legislator introduced a bill saying that no school board may prohibit a teacher from instructing intelligent design. I think the powers that be in the conservative arena said this is hopeless, and it was withdrawn quickly as poorly written. That one would obviously not have gone anywhere, even though the ruling is only controlling in Pennsylvania, Central District of Pennsylvania. It was so well written that I think most people realize intelligent design is now dead too. There was a famous controversy in Texas a few years ago. I won't try and read much of this. You might pick out a few words while I'm talking, but as you can see from it, it has now been resolved. But it was very important because Texas is the second biggest purchaser of textbooks in the U.S., and textbook publishers don't like to publish books that won't be purchased. So they were holding up the publication of certain things, while one anonymous person, an unidentified volunteer reviewer, complained that it presents evolution as scientific fact rather than theory and conflicts with creation story. So the Texas took a couple of years, I think, to figure this out. They had reviews, discussions, etc. They finally said, forget it. We're not going to worry about it. The book has now been approved. But this is the sort of thing that will still happen. You'll see this coming up in Florida in a few more slides. Probably one of the biggest threats, I'll call it a threat, is this idea of providing balance, teaching the controversy. But now they're not talking about creation or Genesis or intelligent design. They just say controversial theories and concepts. And if that's all they're talking about, then maybe it's okay. But most people, including the people who know where this came from, the source of this legislation, realize that the controversial theories are evolution. They also include climate change and some other things now. All right? So these are being introduced. Louisiana actually passed a version of it. The language here is very similar to what I was just talking about, including this phrase I like, cannot promote discrimination for or against a particular set of religious beliefs. I think that's a warning phrase. But it is now law in Louisiana. As I said before, the ACLU has said, okay, it's there, but we want to find out if there are any violations by actually teaching. And they've invited people to let them know if this is being used to teach religion. Virginia, I'm going to speed through these so that we have some time to talk, maybe. Virginia had one in 2014, very similar language. It didn't go anywhere. Oklahoma, similar language. Permit teachers to help students understand, analyze, critique, and review in an objective manner the scientific strengths and scientific weaknesses of existing scientific theories. That's fine, as far as it goes. Similarly, in Ohio, use instructional materials to help understand theories in an objective manner. Later in the bill, it mentions some specific things. Okay, so there's that entire bunch of legislation that simply says, let's have a balanced approach to teaching science. No problems, as far as it goes. Instructional materials, extending that into provide, well, this is really the same thing. Objective, balanced, and non-inflammatory viewpoints on controversial issues. Here's one that I don't actually know. It would allow teaching creation science as long as it's not in a science class. If you're talking about world religions, well, that's perhaps okay. There are bills attacking the NGSS. Connecticut and Iowa specifically tried to repeal it after it had been passed. In Connecticut, they wanted to just remove the material on climate change, etc. Anti-indoctrination bills prohibit teachers from advocating one side or another of a controversial issue. There are a couple of different approaches here. One of them is in Missouri, saying, well, we won't talk about what's taught in the classroom, but if you teach evolution, you have to send a note home and let the parents excuse the children from that day so they don't get exposed to evolution. Here's the Florida bill. It allows any resident to complain about the instructional materials, and it could lead to delays, etc., as in Texas. So, and it is law. Almost in summary, as you can see, there are no really catchy new ideas like intelligent design. They're trying to chip away at just getting something into the classroom. They seek small changes that will permit or require teachers to present alternatives to evolution, and they're undoubtedly looking for an eventual change in the Supreme Court. However, don't think that the battle is won. Don't think that science will continue always to win. 22% of high school biology teachers report receiving explicit community pressure against teaching evolution. I was in a lecture on Monday, and the person said, I got a call from an irate parent telling me that you shouldn't be teaching evolution. And required quite a discussion, apparently. So, what can we do? I have just a couple slides to show you quickly. Be willing to raise your voice. I want you all to think about this. Don't let something just pass you by. If you see the introduction of legislation or the change of a rule at the DNR about climate change or something like that, write a letter. This is a sample letter. You could write it as a parent, as an educator, as a business person, as a person of faith, etc. And have slightly different language. But tell the person who is considering the change that you disagree and why. There's a huge NCSE at the bottom also has library resources, a lot of material which can be used for something like that. Other suggestions from the NCSE. I have to see if I can do this. I'm going to skip this briefly. Well, no, I won't. This is one of my slides that I couldn't get on here. I could scroll down and it's going to go up to about here, but I can't do it on the slideshow. So, things that NCSE suggests that parents do, schools do, beyond the schools, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to end on just a relatively positive note. This is not a great success story because it didn't get passed, but it's what could happen. In 2005, here in Wisconsin, our then local representative, Therese Berceau, joined by other legislators, introduced a bill. It went to the Education Committee, and that was the end of it. But, I mean, this is the sort of legislation that a state could pass alternatively to the other ones. The school board shall ensure that any material presented as science within the school curriculum complies with the material is testable as a scientific hypothesis and describes only natural processes, and the material is consistent with any description of science adopted by the National Academy of Sciences. So, not out of the question. And Do we have time?
Okay.
Alan, you want to tell me what I got wrong and right?
No, not at all. That was just excellent.
Okay, well, you've written, I have a copy of a paper that you co-authored with Therese Brousseau.
We wrote that film, too.
Oh.
I just have a couple of things. One is, it's a little sobering. One of the things that's a little sobering is that the head of the NIH, Francis Collin, is a little bit of a soft creationist himself. Meaning that, you know, you talked about a version of intelligent design that says all of it could not have happened by natural processes. It needed Interventions, divine intervention, or what is often called the God of the Gaps. And Francis Collins has written about that and supports that. He doesn't believe that evolution could have occurred by natural processes alone. And that's, for me, incredibly sobering, because he's a brilliant man, he's a renowned scientist, he works in genetics, that's sobering. And then the other thing that's also difficult is, well, two more things. One is the number of people in the population who believe that all living things have a common origin is very low. Oh. It's getting better. It was 11%, now it's 20%.
Hmm.
So we're up against that, and that's tricky. And then finally, all these cases that you bring up, and you very nicely put it, appeal to fairness, appeal to a very American idea of fairness, equal time. Why not give, if you really have a lot of confidence in your idea, then why are you afraid of hearing an opposing idea, and why would you prevent students from hearing both ideas? So the response to that is very complicated and nuanced, and not everybody and not every high school teacher can come up with it. And I'll just say it quickly. So one of it is that science is not about equal time, actually. Science is progressive. What that means is that we all, when there's a controversy in science, we have a consensus about how to resolve it. We can disagree about the concept, but we can agree about the experiment that's going to resolve it. And then once that experiment is done, if we have agreed on that, we move on. So there was a period of time when the structure of DNA was controversial. The bases on the inside, the phosphates on the outside, or vice versa. Linus Pauling had the wrong idea, Watson and Crick had the right idea. And the crystallography was done, and now we don't teach the Pauling model of DNA. We moved on from that, and nobody's obligated to teach that thing. So science is progressive, and I think that's a very difficult thing to explain.
As you said, average high school teachers will not have that on the tip of their tongue and be able to respond to it. We'll have to stop.